From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with counterterrorism expert Richard Clark about terrorism, homeland security, the grand jury leak investigation, and his new novel. It's a thriller set 5 years in the future after a coup in Saudi Arabia leads the U.S. to plan a war for oil. Clark worked in the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations and resigned in 2003. He's been critical of the Bush administration's handling of terrorism and its decision to go to war in Iraq. Also, actress Claire Danes. She was the embodiment of teenaged alienation when she starred in the TV series My So-Called Life. She's now starring opposite Steve Martin in the movie Shop Girl, which Martin adapted from his best-selling novel of the same name. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Richard Clark, was the National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism in the administrations of Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. After resigning from the Bush administration in 2003, Clark wrote the best-selling memoir, Against All Enemies, which accused the Bush administration of all but ignoring Clark's warnings about the danger of al-Qaeda and instead becoming obsessed with removing Saddam Hussein from power. Since the success of that book, Clark has become a more public figure, appearing frequently on television and writing articles on the subject of terrorism. Now he's written his first novel. It imagines what might happen if the Saudi royal family was overthrown by radical Islamists and the U.S. was ready to go to war for oil. I recorded my interview with Clark yesterday and asked him first about the grand jury investigation into the leaking of CIA agent Valerie Wilson's identity. Richard Clark, what do you think is the larger significance of Patrick Fitzgerald's investigation?
Well, Terry, I think it's part of a pattern that we've seen play out over 20 years in Washington that makes politics vicious, personal, and all too often makes politics and the policy process end up in criminal investigations and criminal activity. And it ruins the lives of people who wanted to serve in government. They don't make a lot of money in government. And then when something like this happens, they have to go out and get very high-priced lawyers, maybe mortgage the house. It ruins the lives of their children who are trying to go through college or whatever. I wish there were a way that we could stop this vicious cycle of recrimination and gotcha personal politics.
Nevertheless, how do you feel about the fact that this leak is being investigated? I mean, I understand your feelings about that these investigations disillusion people with politics and prevent them maybe from going into politics, but do you think it's appropriate that the leak be investigated?
The fact that there was an investigation, I think, is fine because there was at least initially a question of whether or not a law was broken. But I think in the larger sense, if there's a way that we can do these investigations without them being criminal, we only have the one tool right now. We only have the one hammer, and so everything looks like a nail. And there really ought to be a way that we can investigate this kind of thing, have an impartial investigator who issues a fact finding the way the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have done in South Africa and El Salvador and elsewhere, and not have to drag it through the criminal process, which is really inappropriate in this case, I think.
What do you think? No crime was committed?
I think the consensus, and we'll see, of course, later, but I think the consensus has been that the law on revealing the identities of CIA agents probably wasn't violated. And it's likely that, in fact, what people will be charged with will be other things stemming from the investigation itself. And while I have no sympathy for the policy views of Karl Rove, heavens knows that, but I do have some sympathy for anybody who gets caught up in an investigation where the investigation was originally about one thing and that doesn't end up being prosecuted. But you then end up prosecuting people for something that happened as a result of the investigation itself.
The cover-up.
The cover-up or the confusion of what the record was that turns into perjury. Or, you know, it's very, very difficult. And I know this from my own experience with the 9/11 Commission and the 16 hours of testimony I did in closed session, and the testimony I did in closed session with the House and Senate. It is very, very difficult when you're in one of these jobs where the world is coming at you at 100 miles an hour all day long for 12 and 14 hours a day, and you're in there 6-plus days a week, year after year. It is very difficult to remember the details of what happened when and who said what to whom, because the investigators are looking at one thing. And for them, the spotlight, the Klieg light is on that, and that's the only thing they care about. But for you, at the time, it may not have been a very important thing. And you don't really remember the details, and then perhaps you get caught up in misstatements and it ends up in perjury.
A lot of observers think that the leak of Valerie Wilson's name was an attempt to discredit her husband, Joseph Wilson, who criticized what the president was saying about weapons of mass destruction. And I'm wondering if you share that opinion, that this was an attempt to discredit Joe Wilson, and if you see it as part of a larger effort in the Bush administration to discredit critics.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a very clear pattern, and it comes out of Karl Rove's office and Karl Rove himself, a very clear pattern that you don't talk about the substance of the criticism. You talk about the person who's making the criticism. So you take the debate off the issue, and you make it a more political name-calling, personal thing. Rove has been doing that for years, long before he even came to Washington. And it's a real disservice to the country, because people should have a right to stand up and be a whistleblower or otherwise call into question government policies and have a policy discussion about facts and about opinion and about the substantive issues at play without having Karl Rove and his agents out there trying to discredit them, their motivations, their relations with their wife who happens to be a CIA agent. It's worse than I've ever seen it in Washington. I think there's always been that tactic, but this White House uses it repeatedly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Clark, and he had served as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism under Presidents Clinton and Bush. He left the Bush administration, wrote a book very critical of Bush administration's approach to counterterrorism. And now he has a new novel that's also critical of the war in Iraq, critical of the Bush administration's approach to counterterrorism, but this is through the form of fiction. And the novel is called The Scorpion's Gate. Richard Clark, in your novel, Iraq is still not much different than it looks now. There's still an insurgency underway in Iraq, even though your novel set a few years into the future. So I take that as a sign that you don't think things are going to get a lot better anytime in the immediate future.
Well, in the novel, which is set in the year 2011, there's still a low-grade insurgency by Sunnis against the majority Shia government in Iraq. And the majority Shia government in Iraq is very close to the leadership of Iran. I think we're pretty close to having that situation today. Iran has turned out to be the big winner as an unintended consequence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I think we could see a future in which Iraq breaks up into two or three countries. Our greatest concern has to be that one of them isn't an al-Qaeda sanctuary. And to some extent, the Sunni areas in Iraq are already something of an al-Qaeda training ground. The CIA apparently had a report earlier this year that said that the old al-Qaeda training ground of Afghanistan has in effect been replaced by Iraq, where people from all over the world go, jihadists, jihadist wannabes from all over the world go, get training from al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then actually participate in attacks on American troops, and after a while take their expertise and go back to where they came from.
You mentioned they get trained, the terrorists get trained by al-Qaeda in Iraq. I feel like I don't hear nearly as much about al-Qaeda as I did a few years ago. I hear a lot about terrorists, but not necessarily al-Qaeda. Is it like officially the brand name al-Qaeda who's training these terrorists, or is it just kind of terrorist training camps?
Well, the organization that is getting most of the foreign fighters in Iraq is an organization that gave itself the name al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, or al-Qaeda in Iraq. But the reason you don't hear the name al-Qaeda so much anymore is that the original al-Qaeda organization, I think, has been largely destroyed, but it spawned 14 or 15 different groups with all sorts of different names around the world. And if you look at the number of attacks that led up to 9/11. Take the 36 months prior to 9/11. Look at the number of al-Qaeda attacks around the world. Then look at the 36 months after 9/11, and al-Qaeda and its related organizations committed double the number of attacks. So the network, the al-Qaeda network, is alive and well.
Colin Powell's former right-hand man at the State Department said recently that the vice president and the secretary of defense had created a Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal that hijacked U.S. foreign policy. What was your reaction when you saw this statement?
Well, it was pretty obvious to those of us in Washington who've been following it. I don't think there's any real dispute that Rumsfeld and Cheney stopped the normal process of all of the national security agencies getting together, of the White House doing oversight, of the White House doing a policy development process, and of the State Department being an equal player. I think that clearly Cheney and Rumsfeld had their ideas very early on about what they wanted to do, which was to invade and occupy Iraq. And it didn't really matter to them what the State Department or experts in the Middle East, or even experts in uniform, like General Shinseki, the head of the U.S. Army, it didn't matter what they said. They were going to go ahead and do this invasion of Iraq.
As we spend so much of our military power, our weapons, and our focus on Iraq, are there other issues internationally that you think we should be paying attention to that we're not because of all the resources that are going into Iraq?
Well, I think if you go back to 2001, to the period immediately after the 9/11 attacks, we had a choice. We could throw everything into going after al-Qaeda and the terrorist movement, or we could do that and go after Iraq. And remarkably, I thought at the time, remarkably, we chose the latter. We had just been attacked in a very vicious way by al-Qaeda. And rather than throw all of our resources into going after them and their affiliate organizations around the world, we decided to do that and Iraq. Now, the downside of that is not just that our resources were diluted, but that by going into Iraq, we increased the propaganda value that al-Qaeda had. We actually turned more people into being terrorists. We made the problem worse for ourselves. And you have to wonder, the road not taken, if we had only gone after al-Qaeda and terrorism and left Saddam Hussein confined, bottled up successfully. Secretary of State Powell had testified before the Congress that we had successfully contained Iraq. If we had put the Iraq problem on the back burner and just focused on terrorism, what could we have done? And how would we now be regarded in the Islamic world? Right now, we're regarded in most of the Islamic world as an enemy. And countries like Egypt and Jordan and Pakistan, countries that were our allies, now you have 70, 80, 90% of the people in those countries with very hostile views of the United States. And we'll pay a price for that.
My guest is counterterrorism expert Richard Clark. He's written his first novel. It's called The Scorpion's Gate. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Clark, and he had served as coordinator for security, national coordinator for security and counterterrorism under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. After resigning from the Bush administration, he wrote a bestseller called Against All Enemies, in which he criticized the Bush administration for its lack of attention to terrorism before September 11th. Now he's written a new novel, that's set 5 years in the future and looks at the possibility of another war in the Middle East pertaining to oil. And that novel is called The Scorpion's Gate. Many people have been critical of FEMA's response to Hurricane Katrina. In 1993, you were one of the chairs of a task force on emergency responders. And the report, to give a sense of what's in it, the report was titled Emergency Responders Drastically Underfunded and Dangerously Unprepared. So I guess that gives a tidy summary of what you thought of the condition of emergency responders. So do you feel like you were able to see the poor response to Katrina? Were you able to see that coming?
Well, I think a lot of people were. You know, if you go back to 1992... FEMA had done a terrible job in Florida responding to Hurricane Andrew. And when the Clinton administration then came in 93, they decided to rebuild FEMA, make it a cabinet-level agency, fill it with professionals in emergency management. And that is a profession. People spend their entire careers. It's an expertise. And the Clinton administration, I think, largely rebuilt FEMA. Then the Bush administration came in, merged FEMA into this new behemoth, the Department of Homeland Security, so it's no longer a cabinet agency, pushed it down about three levels, cut its budget and cut its personnel strength, and then populated it again with political appointees rather than professionals. And people around Washington knew that was going on. People in Washington predicted that we would have another Hurricane Andrew situation. And unfortunately, that happened with Katrina, only it was much, much worse.
Why was the budget to FEMA cut?
Well, it's very interesting. It goes back to the whole creation of this new Department of Homeland Security. Originally, the Bush administration was opposed to a new department. Then they realized that Senator Lieberman, a Democrat from Connecticut, was going to pass a bill over the administration's objections, creating a new department. And so they were faced with the prospect that the first major thing the Congress did after 9/11 was to pass the Lieberman bill on Homeland Security. The White House didn't want that. They wanted it, if it was going to pass, to be theirs. So they changed their position on a dime and said, we have a good idea. We're going to create the Department of Homeland Security, almost exactly what Lieberman was proposing. And to do that, they swept up all of these agencies and put them in one agency, which is kind of a crazy thing to do when you were fighting a war on terrorism, to rearrange all the organization, rearrange all the chairs. But on top of it, their guidance to the new department was, we're going to do all of this without spending any more money. And in fact, as a result of the reorganization, we'd like to save money. And so they started looking around for where they could save money, and they cut FEMA.
You write in the Atlantic Monthly that the White House inner tribe believes that a strong Department of Homeland Security is not only unnecessary, but even antithetical to the administration's political philosophy and interests. Why?
Well, I think the administration doesn't like what they call big government. So it pained them to create a new agency, the Transportation Security Agency, and hire 40,000 more federal employees. And it pains them to give out federal dollars in block grants to the states, particularly because if you give out money to the states that are most at risk of terrorism and where most of the assets are, they turn out to be blue states. And I think the administration would rather do almost anything than give money to places like New York and California and Massachusetts.
You also write in this article that the Bush administration thinks that since three-quarters of al-Qaeda's managers are captured or killed, why spend vast sums of money defending against al-Qaeda? But you think that al-Qaeda, even if the old al-Qaeda has been pretty much weakened, that all the new terrorist groups are doing quite well in terms of their strength. So I guess you think Homeland Security is obviously very important.
Well, that's right. I mean, you get these administration slogans that become sort of bumper stickers or mantras. We'd rather fight them over there than fight them here. And then you hear, three-quarters of the al-Qaeda managers have been captured or killed. But when you start peeling the onion back on some of these little slogans of theirs, you learn some troublesome things. Three-quarters of the al-Qaeda managers who were managers on September 11th have been captured or killed. They've also been replaced by other terrorist leaders and other terrorist organizations. And if you look at captured or killed, many of the al-Qaeda leadership is captured by Iran and allegedly under house arrest. But I think, you know, house arrest in Iran, if you're an al-Qaeda terrorist, is probably even better than Camp Cupcake that Martha Stewart went to.
This is interesting that Iran has captured a lot of the leaders of al-Qaeda.
A lot of the leaders of al-Qaeda, the members of the Shura Council, their so-called board of directors, fled when we invaded Afghanistan, fled west into Iran. And it includes people like bin Laden's oldest son and other leaders of the organization. And it raises, since Iran will not give them to us for prosecution, I think it raises serious questions about what is the relationship between Iran and al-Qaeda, both now and what was it before September 11th.
Richard Clark served as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism in the administrations of Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. His new novel is called The Scorpion's Gate. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Claire Danes talks about growing up in front of the camera when she starred on the TV series My So-Called Life. She's now starring opposite Steve Martin in the movie adaptation of his novel Shop Girl. Also, we continue our interview with counterterrorism expert Richard Clark. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Richard Clark, former National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism in the administrations of Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. He's just written his first novel, The Scorpion's Gate. When we left off, Clark was saying that after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, some of al-Qaeda's leaders fled west into Iran, where they are under house arrest. Iran still refuses to hand them over to the U.S. for prosecution. Clark thinks this raises serious questions about the relationship of Iran and al-Qaeda. He speculates about that relationship in his novel.
Since it's fiction, I can say a bit more. I have one of the characters laying out a plausible scenario which was that a secret organization that does in fact exist inside Iran called the Quds Force or the Jerusalem Force may have been supporting al-Qaeda very secretly all along.
What is this Quds Force that you write about from Iran?
Quds Force is a combination covert action intelligence group and a military organization. But it's not part of the military, and it's not part of the intelligence ministry. It reports directly to the Supreme Ayatollah, which means it really reports to nobody. It is its own organization. It was involved in killing the American Marines in Beirut back in the 1980s. It was involved in killing the American Air Force personnel at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia in the 1990s. It was the force that killed people in Argentina when the Jewish centers in Buenos Aires were bombed. It created Hezbollah in Lebanon. It is now deeply involved in Iraq and influencing events behind the scenes in Iraq. It is radical, deeply anti-American, and something that we just don't hear about very much.
And why don't we hear about it very much?
Well, they don't like publicity. And
kind of the opposite of al-Qaeda.
The exact opposite of al-Qaeda. And oftentimes, I think the president of Iran or the foreign minister of Iran have no idea what the Quds Force is doing. In the novel, the Quds Force is trying to engineer a coup in Bahrain, which is where the United States has a big Navy base, and there is a large Shia population, to throw the Americans out of the Navy base in Bahrain. And they're trying to cause an uprising of the Shia, who are the majority in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. These are fairly realistic things because I believe the Quds Force has tried some of this in the past.
So is this something that you see happening, that of the Shia of different countries, Iraq, Iran, aligning?
I think Iran is trying very hard to do that. If you step back and look at it in perspective, during the 1980s, Iran fought a war for 7 years against Iraq. Over 1 million people died in that war, many, many more casualties. A lot of chemical weapons were used. The two nations fought each other to the point of exhaustion, and there was no real winner. Now, several years later, the United States Army comes along, invades Iraq, and gives Iran all of the goals that they sought in that earlier war. Getting rid of Saddam Hussein, ensuring that there were no Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, putting the Shia religious ethnic group in charge of Iraq. All of that has now been achieved. And I've heard people who spent a lot of time in Iraq lately say that Tehran, the government in Tehran, has more influence now in Iraq than we do. That we may have been the ones who spent the $300 billion. We may have been the ones with the 20,000 casualties. But it's Iran which is reaping the profit.
So Richard Clark, you now have your first novel, The Scorpion's Gate. Did you, I don't take this the wrong way, but did you write it yourself? A lot of people who aren't actual fiction writers by birth end up having, a ghostwriters or, you know, somebody working with them to help them craft it.
No, I'm afraid all the mistakes are mine. All the book is mine. The White House said my last book was a piece of fiction, so maybe this is my second my second fiction. No, I enjoyed writing fiction because I enjoy reading fiction. And I did find it to be a way in which I can do a little bit of telling people things they don't know about what it's like on the inside, telling people a little bit that they may not know about the Middle East and its history and its present.
One place where I think former government people who end up writing thrillers, one place where I think they kind of go wrong is when they include sex scenes. You know, those tarred, passionate sex scenes in which, like, the Undersecretary of Defense meets a vixen or, you know, who happens to be also working in government or something. And there's they're always just like they really fall flat and are sometimes actually kind of embarrassing. So when you were writing this book, did you decide that you were going to go there or not go there?
Well, I assumed, as with all great thrillers, you had to have the scene. And then the former national security advisor, Anthony Lake, said to me, "So I hear you're writing a novel." I said, "Yes." He said, "Don't have a sex scene."
Did he say why?
He said exactly what you said. He said, "All of these people in government who tried to write sex scenes write them as though they were writing an interagency report."
So do you think it was good advice?
I think it's very good advice, and I took it. There may be a little affair in the novel, The Scorpion's Gate, but it's a little subtle.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Richard Clark has written his first novel. It's called The Scorpion's Gate. Coming up, Claire Danes. She's starring in the new movie Shop Girl. This is Fresh Air. My guest Claire Danes became the embodiment of teenaged alienation when she starred in the 1994 TV series My So-Called Life, playing a 15-year-old high school student. Although the series lasted only 19 episodes, it had a devoted following and got great reviews, especially for Danes' acting. She's since starred in a number of stylistically wide-ranging films, including Little Women, The Mod Squad, Romeo and Juliet, Igby Goes Down, The Hours, and Terminator 3. Now she's starring in the film Shop Girl, which Steve Martin adapted from his best-selling novel. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott described Danes' performance as flawless. Danes plays a lonely young woman working at Saks Fifth Avenue in L.A., where she meets an older man, played by Steve Martin, who buys her a gift and takes her out to dinner.
Need some date questions. Where's your family, then?
Vermont.
Okay. Be honest. Maybe. If this were a TV dating show, would I be kicked off already and you'd be on to the next guy?
You'd still be on the show.
Claire Danes, welcome to Fresh Air. You're in your mid-20s and Steve Martin is around 60. That's a pretty big age disparity. Mm-hmm. Was it hard for you to think of your character as being attracted to someone of that age?
Well, he has a lot of attributes that were pretty obvious to her, I think. She wasn't so fazed by the discrepancy in their ages. I don't know. He was successful and confident and seductive, and he was a real grown up. And I think she is at a point in her life where she's struggling to figure out what that means. So I think she wanted to, I don't know, inherit some of those qualities or learn about them, study them. That appealed to her.
Was this age disparity something that you talked with Steve Martin about? The character's, I think, like in his 50s in the script. I think Martin's a little older than the character.
Yeah.
Because he wrote it, you know, a while ago. He wrote it several years ago.
A while ago, yeah. And I think I was younger than I was meant to be. Mm-hmm. So the gulf in our age was even more extreme than it was meant to be. But I don't know. It wasn't such an issue, oddly enough. I mean, I was preoccupied with just playing the scene authentically. But, yeah, no, I wasn't, like, creeped out or anything, if that's what you mean. It's okay. Look, I mean, playing love scenes with anybody who's not really your partner is kind of creepy, to be honest. This was just another version of that. I mean, Jason Schwartzman plays the other paramour, and he's been my good friend for many years, and that was more awkward because I felt like, I don't know, I was transgressing some boundary or something. But, right. Yeah.
Well, so. You know, this is a leading lady role for you and a sexualized one. There are several intimate scenes. And you are aware of the sexual power, you become aware of the sexual power you have as a younger woman in the life of this older man. What has it been like for you to go from being like, you know, the teenage kid on camera to being, you know, a woman and a sexualized one at that?
I'm glad I had time to act in a way that was stripped of any objectification or, I don't know, sexual pressure, because it was easier and it was nice. And I can recall that time. I remember on my so-called life, the woman who played my mother, Beth Armstrong, was talking about having been hit on by crew members or by directors in the past and having that been aggravating and like a hazard. And she said, you'll see one day that will become a factor. And, you know, it really wasn't at that point. And I felt freer to just concentrate on the work without wondering if I was being looked at funny by the other collaborators or by audience members. Or so that's just part of it.
In your career, you've done a mix of independent and commercial films. I want to ask you about one of the independent films that you did, which was called mm-hmm. Igby Goes Down. Mm-hmm. And you play a disaffected college dropout who has met at a party a disaffected high school dropout, played by Kieran Culkin. And you've just run into each other, and you've gone to a park and are talking there while you are rolling a joint. Here's the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Are you vegetarian?
Why would you ask that?
I've just never seen anybody roll a joint like that.
What does that have to do with being a vegetarian?
Well, they're just so precious.
I roll perfect joints.
I'm not putting them down. They're incredible.
Well, thank you.
It's incredible that a human being could make such neat little joints.
You make it sound as if I'm anal or something just because I know how to roll a perfect joint.
No, not anal. Vegetarian.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, you don't roll like big Rasta spliff joints, do you? Your joints are like salad joints, not like a big, sloppy, bleeding cheeseburger that you rip into kind of a joint.
I guess marijuana isn't a visceral experience for me. Sex is for me.
Right.
Okay, so I am a vegetarian, but for purely moral reasons.
Uh-huh. I thought you went to school at Brandeis or someplace.
Bennington, I do.
Why aren't you there?
I took a semester off. I need time to recuperate.
From what?
Edmund's cookies, beer, diet pills, tension. Life.
My dad's been recuperating for 6 years.
What do you mean?
From life, nothing.
Let's go.
Yeah. Come a long way, baby.
You're funny.
Claire Danes, at what point were you in your life when you decided to say yes to making this film, Igby Goes Down?
Well, I was in college. I guess it was after my... I think that's when I just dropped out of college myself. So it was very easy to draw from my own personal experience. I finished my first two, and it turns out only, years at Yale. And I had done The Hours, and I was just starting to return to acting after having abandoned it for about 3 years. Yeah, it was a good time. I adored that character. She was so fantastically ridiculous. And her name was Sookie Saperstein. And I just thought, that is a perfect place to start. But she was very familiar, and I'd been in the company of those kinds of pretentious students. I mean, very recently at that point. But, I, you know, she's a New York kid, too, and I'm a New York kid, and I get that there's a... They can be much more mature than they really are because they appropriate these adult behaviors and gestures, but it's not truly reflective of where they're at emotionally.
Great perception. Do you feel that ever described you as a young actress who was starring in a TV series by the age of 14? Did you appear more mature than you were or felt?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do attribute that to having been raised partially by this city and by parents who were really progressive and liberal and always took me really seriously. So I was never condescended to or patronized, and, you know, my voice was... always had resonance and meaning and weight, and but yeah.
Now, why had you dropped out of college? Let's back up. Why did you drop out of acting and go to college?
Well, I guess I always knew that I wanted to go to college, and I didn't really go to high school. I mean, I was enrolled at a place called Le Lycée Français in L.A., but was never really there, or would go very infrequently and sporadically, you know, a week here, a week there. But mostly I was tutored. And I was lonely, you know, and I sacrificed a lot of, you know, socialization. And I didn't really have a chance to just hang out with kids my own age. So I wanted to reclaim that a little bit for myself. And I also had been acting for a long time, and I started to get a lot of attention and a lot of success and influence, and I just had no idea what to do with all of that. I mean, I was overwhelmed by it, and, you know, I didn't know what movies I wanted to see, never mind what movies I wanted to make. I didn't know what my value system was. I didn't know what my sensibility was, and I really needed to take some time to figure that out.
My guest is Claire Danes. She's now starring in Shop Girl. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Claire Danes stars opposite Steve Martin in the new film Shop Girl. In 1994, she starred in the critically acclaimed but short-lived TV series My So-Called Life. She played 15-year-old Angela Chase. Angela narrated each episode. In this scene from the pilot, she's sitting at the dining room table with her parents and younger sister.
I cannot bring myself to eat a well-balanced meal in front of my mother. It just means too much to her. I mean, if you stop to think about, like, chewing, what it really is, how people just do it, like, in public.
Wait, don't tell me. There's something different.
I would never dye my hair red.
It's not red. It's crimson glow.
Oh. Well, I could see it now. The social whirl, wild parties, Axl Rose.
My dad thinks every person in the world is having more fun than him, which could be true.
Oh, what am I supposed to say?
Nothing.
I mean, it's her hair.
Exactly. And we'll always be able to spot you in a crowd.
Lately, I can't even look at my mother without wanting to stab her repeatedly.
The role that made you famous, of course, was My So-Called Life, the TV series in which you were a high school student. It was a really wonderful series. How did you get the part in this?
I auditioned. That's what happens early in a person's career. And then I got it. And we did the pilot when I was 13, and it didn't get picked up. So I went back to high school, and I did a semester at a place called Dalton on the Upper East Side. And then it did get picked up. And so then I went back to L.A. and shot 19 episodes, and then it was canceled. But
yeah,
it's been picked up by so many cable networks and has had this epic afterlife and is still the thing that is most commonly associated with me.
Did you learn to see your own experiences differently by getting out of yourself to be her? In other words, you had to approach her in a more analytical way than you would just approach day-to-day life, probably. I mean, you live your life, but you have to craft that character. So did you start to see your teenage experiences differently through portraying Angela?
Well, it was funny because I was sacrificing my conventional adolescent experience so that I could play it on television, so that I could represent it. And to do both simultaneously was a little tricky. But it was interesting because we were really exactly at the same point in our development. And, you know, sometimes there'd be an episode that would involve a certain theme or a certain experience that I hadn't had personally, so I'd have to imagine it. And then a week later, I would have it. You know, I would catch up, and sometimes it was the other way around. So it was like playing a game of tag with Angela. You know, sometimes she was it, sometimes I was it. But it was interesting. It was like having a very public diary, but with somebody else's words.
Can you think of an instance, like a specific example of when you portrayed something in My So-Called Life and then the week after it happened to you, or vice versa,
yeah,
it happened to you and then it ended up in the script?
Oh, God. Well, I remember there was a makeout scene with Jared Leto or Jordan Catalano, and I didn't really know how to make out at that point. And there was, you know, this instruction to kiss him on the face, and I was like, what? How, why would you do that? And I didn't know how to interpret it at all, and he had to give me a little lesson. Which was really cute, but yeah, it was stuff like that.
Reading a little bit about your professional life made me think about the career that you almost had and didn't—the career where you starred in Titanic and Lolita.
Oh, right,
which were,
right,
were roles that I think you were offered and turned down or almost got. I'm not sure,
yeah,
which.
Yeah, no, Titanic, I guess I could have done. I don't know. I just done an epic love story with Leonardo DiCaprio in Mexico City and
Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, exactly. And so the next job would have been potentially the Titanic, which was to be shot in Mexico City with Leonardo DiCaprio. But I just did that. I don't need to do that again. It seemed a little redundant.
Okay, well, seeing what a huge success the film was, did you have any regrets?
No, not really. I personally didn't really connect with that material, and I know that Kate Winslet did, so I'm so glad that she did it.
How important to you is it to personally connect with material? Like, did you personally connect to Terminator 3?
Well, not really, no, but that was interesting because I was offered that role literally the day before I started working, and I had done...
Somebody had dropped out and they needed a replacement.
Yeah,
quickly.
Somebody else had been cast and was like deemed too young or something. So yeah, they were in a panic and needed to find someone else really quickly. And I just come from Australia that afternoon when I got the call. So I was in L.A. expecting only to be there for a couple of days before I was to return to New York, just to, like, cushion the jet lag, sort of. And I was delirious and and available. And thought, okay. But I just made a really experimental movie in Denmark with a director named Thomas Vinterberg and Joaquin Phoenix, and it didn't really work, and my heart was a bit broken by that. And so I think the chance to do something really conventional and conservative and big and splashy, it was a welcome contrast at that point.
I'll confess I haven't seen Terminator 3, so I don't know if you get to, you know, carry a gun and mow people
down.
Oh,
I do. Okay. I do. I fire a machine gun. It made my whole body vibrate, that thing. And that was one of the days that my mom chose to visit on set, and I was worried for her. I don't think she ever envisioned her little girl growing up to shoot a machine gun. But it was not a characteristic choice of mine,
right,
at all.
Claire Danes, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Claire Danes stars in the new movie Shop Girl. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillock, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Dial Trade Paperbacks, publisher of A Dictionary of Macau, a novel in dictionary format by Han Xiaogang. And from Entrepreneur Magazine, presenting its annual Young Millionaires issue, featuring millionaires under 40. The November issue is on newsstands now. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
To fill the need for cheap labor in Iraq, the U.S. military's contractors are bringing in foreign workers through an illicit pipeline. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Cam Simpson of the Chicago Tribune. He investigated this pipeline while retracing the journeys of several workers from Nepal who were kidnapped and executed as soon as they got to Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.